Imagine paying $50,000 for this highly confidential, top secret scientific blueprint, like an actual revolutionary architecture of the human mind.
Right.
And then, you know, you log onto the internet the very next day and you see the inventor just giving away that exact same blueprint for free.
Oh.
Yeah. To literally everyone.
I mean, honestly, it sounds like a scam or, you know, at the very least, just a terrible business model.
That is exactly what you would think. But today, we're dissecting a legal masterpiece, or I guess a legal nightmare, depending on, you know, which side of the negotiating table you're sitting on.
Absolutely.
So welcome to another deep dive. You, our listener, have sent us this absolutely massive stack of theoretical documents from the Brizart Research Archive.
It was a huge stack.
Huge. And we're talking about incredibly dense papers here.
Yeah.
Stuff on cognitive frameworks, emotional reconsolidation, predictive loops, and the structural mathematics of human consciousness.
But we are actually going to do something drastically different today.
Yeah, we are.
We're putting on our lawyer hats.
Exactly. We are looking at this stack of documents purely from a legalistic perspective. We are lawyers today, not researchers.
Right. I mean, we are going to briefly go over the frameworks just so you understand the stakes of what's actually being bought and sold here.
Yeah, you need the context.
Right. But we are actively announcing right now that our primary focus is the legal architecture holding this entire enterprise together.
And just to be clear, we are carefully avoiding sharing any protected intellectual property, right?
Yeah.
Or any specific proprietary data that could, you know, tip people off to the core mathematical mechanics of these theories.
Which is absolutely necessary because, well, the centerpiece of the documents you sent us is this single, highly restrictive contract.
Oh, it's intense.
It's the Academic Research License Agreement for the Brizart Research Archive. And looking at how the law works in this agreement, I mean, it is a masterclass in aggressive intellectual property control.
It really is. And the central mystery we're investigating today revolves around the creator of these frameworks, this independent researcher named Jason Brizart. He is charging academic labs this flat, non-refundable licensing fee of $50,000.
50 grand.
50 grand. And in exchange, these labs get access to his cognitive frameworks, but they are bound by some of the heaviest non-disclosure agreements I have, like, ever seen in academia.
And yet, as you hinted at the beginning, he's publicly, you know, deliberately staggering the release of these exact same frameworks on open access repositories.
He is literally just putting them out there.
Right, on the internet.
So the fundamental question we have to answer for you today is this. Knowing how these frameworks are being released publicly, why on earth any university lab actually sign this agreement?
It's the $1 million question.
Sure.
Or the $50,000 question.
Right. Like, would a lab truly risk the immense liability and that extremely NDA-heavy licensing fee to ensure they get access when they could just, you know, sit back and wait for the public drop?
And to understand why a lab would actually take that risk, we have to look at the intersection of intellectual property law, institutional risk management, and frankly, the cutthroat psychology of academic competition.
Yeah, let's start with the economics and this trap that Brizart has basically set up.
Let's do it.
So, looking at Section 1 and Section 6 of the license agreement, the baseline terms are incredibly stark. The license, so let's say major tier one research university, they pay $50,000 US.
Right.
For that money, they get a 12-month non-exclusive, non-transferable right to use the Brizart Research Archive for internal non-commercial research.
And we really need to pause on that phrase, non-refundable.
Oh, yeah.
Because under Section 7.2 of this contract, even if the university terminates the agreement, like a week later, or if they realize halfway through the year that the math just doesn't work for their specific clinical trial,
they don't get a dime back.
Not a single dime. You are buying a one-year lease to just look at Jason Brizart's finalized non-public theoretical frameworks, his symbolic schematics, his structural models, and his formal research templates.
But then we hit this thing that I'm calling the Zenodo conundrum.
I like that name.
Because you look at the sources you provided us, and there is this glaring contradiction just staring us in the face. These frameworks are not actually locked in a vault. Jason Brizart has been actively uploading them to Zenodo,
which is an open access scientific repository.
Right. The staggered release strategy. It is brilliant marketing, I'll give him that. But it creates this fascinating legal tension.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, he has uploaded the temporal feedback loop, or TFL. He's uploaded simulation synchronization theory, SST, the intent resolution engine, IRE.
He even uploaded an old version of the Brizart format, right?
Yes. his proprietary manuscript template. And just recently, I noticed he actually unprivated PFT, Perceptual Frame Theory. It's right there on Zenodo.
Just sitting there.
Sitting right there on the internet for anyone with a Wi-Fi connection to download.
But they are not sitting there without strings attached. And this is where the legal architecture basically tightens around the throat of the scientific method.
Yeah, explain that.
Well, every single one of those public uploads is bound by a specific, heavily restrictive license.
Right. The Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License.
The NCND.
Hey, that one.
And the No Derivatives Clause, the ND part.
Yeah.
That is the absolute linchpin of this entire strategy.
Because you can't build on it.
Exactly. In the scientific community, the lifeblood of research is the ability to build upon prior work. You know, you take a hypothesis, you tweak the variables, you create a derivative model, and you test it against new data.
So basically, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but this feels exactly like a software freemium model.
That's an interesting way to look at it.
Right. Like, labs can read the frameworks that Bressart releases for free. Any grad student can download TFL or SST and read all about recursive simulations. But in order to literally do anything other than read them, you have to cough up $50,000 for the licensing fee.
Yep.
Again, that's my take. Does that strategy make a lick of sense in the scientific community? And if so, why don't labs do it that way even more? Like, why wouldn't a lab simply review the documents during the staggered release?
I will actually go a step further than a freemium model. It's almost like a hostage situation.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah. I mean, in freemium software, you just miss out on the premium features, right? Maybe you get ads or you can't save files in a certain format. Here, if you touch the free version the wrong way, you are legally liable for intellectual property infringement.
Wait, explain how that works in practice. How does just reading a science paper become an IP violation?
Okay, let's take the temporal feedback loop, the TFL. For you, the listener, to grasp the stakes here, we need to understand what this framework theoretically does.
Right. The stakes are huge.
TFL models how a cognitive system can basically get stuck in a recursive loop, essentially predicting its own past to stabilize its current identity.
Which is fascinating.
It is. And if a lab can map that mathematically, it could revolutionize how we treat PTSD, for example, where patients are trapped in emotional feedback loops. It's incredibly valuable science.
Okay, so a clinical psychology lab downloads the TFL paper from Zenodo for free. They read it.
Reading it is fine, perfectly legal. But science isn't just reading.
Right.
To use it, they have to test it.
Uh-huh.
Let's say they take the TFL recursive loop equations and they adapt those equations to fit a new clinical study they're designing for trauma patients.
Okay.
They tweak the symbolic schematic to account for real-time biometric data. Then they write a paper about their findings and publish that adapted schematic.
Which is literally how normal science works. You stand on the shoulders of giants, you adapt their models, you publish the results.
But under the Creative Commons No Derivatives license, they have just committed copyright infringement. The ND clause explicitly forbids distributing modified versions of the work. You cannot build a modified hypothesis or publish an adapted schematic based on his specific proprietary symbols and structures without violating the license. The moment they tweak the TFL equation for their PTSD study, they create a derivative work.
That is wild. It's like being handed the blueprints to a revolutionary skyscraper for free. But the moment you try to build a slightly taller version of it or, you know, move a load-bearing wall to fit your specific city block, the architect sues you for everything you own.
That is a perfect analogy. I mean, they can cite the original Bressart paper in a literature review. They can say, you know, Bressart's theory of TFL suggests X, but they cannot legally derive new functional models from it.
And this is exactly why labs will pay the $50,000 fee despite the staggered public releases.
Yes, it comes down to first mover advantage.
So the fee basically buys them out of the Creative Commons trap.
Exactly. When a lab pays the $50,000, they are executing a B2B, a business-to-business contract, that supersedes the public Creative Commons license. By paying, they unlock Section 2.3 of the Academic Research License Agreement.
I actually have Section 2.3 right here. It's the academic use exception. It says the licensee may develop and publish original academic research inspired by or informed through the archive.
Right. For $50,000, the lab buys the legal right to actually do science with the frameworks.
Because otherwise they're stuck.
Completely. If a lab relies solely on the staggered public releases, they are paralyzed. They can only review the documents. Meanwhile, a competing university that paid the licensing fee is already integrating the models. They're running the PTSD trials and preparing derivative academic outpoints.
Yeah, the paying lab gets a massive first-mover advantage.
Huge. They get to publish the groundbreaking empirical studies, secure the next round of multi-million-dollar federal grants, and claim all the prestige, while the non-paying lab is legally forced to just sit there and run the theory.
It's brilliantly manipulative. I mean, Brizard is staggering these frameworks online under CCNCND to build hype. He is proving to the scientific community that his models, you know, TFL, SST, IRE, that they are legitimate, deeply thought out architectures.
He lets the lab see the brilliance for free.
He baits the hook. He generates the internal demand from the scientists themselves.
And once the lead scientist at a university realizes the potential breakthrough of the framework, say they read the newly unprivated perceptual frame theory, PFT.
Oh, right, PFT.
Yeah, and they realize it perfectly models how human beings temporarily lock onto a sense of self. They realize they are legally barred from acting on it. The public release creates the intense desire, and the no derivatives clause creates the legal bottleneck.
And the only way through that bottleneck is a Disrael Council writing a $50,000 check.
Exactly.
You mentioned the unprivating of PFT. What are the pros and cons for Brizard in doing this sequential release? Like, how does it affect labs genuinely believing in his frameworks?
Well, the pros are immense marketing visibility and academic validation. By releasing PFT sequentially, you know, months after TFL and SST, he creates this ongoing narrative.
Right.
He isn't just some guy with a single isolated theory. He's a prolific architect releasing a unified, interlocking system of consciousness theory over time. It establishes his authority.
It makes him look like a heavyweight.
It does. When labs see a consistent, rigorous output, their belief in the validity of his framework skyrockets.
So the more he publishes, the more real it becomes to the establishment.
Precisely. It proves the frameworks are expansive and robust.
Yeah.
But the con, however, is that by making it public, he loses the absolute secrecy of a pure trade secret.
Because it's out there.
Right. Every time he uploads to Zenodo, he is giving away a piece of the proprietary puzzle, which leads to this massive tension in his legal strategy when it comes to the unreleased materials.
And that tension brings us to the second major area of our legal analysis, what I'm calling the NDA fortress versus the public blogger.
Yes, because while he is releasing some things publicly, the things he hasn't released are guarded by dragons.
Seriously, looking at Section 2 of the license agreement, confidentiality and restrictions, it is incredibly draconian. There's a 5-year confidentiality period on all unreleased materials within the archive.
5 years in academia is an eternity.
It really is. And it explicitly bans reproducing the material in its entirety. Like, you can't quote verbatim the proprietary structural elements. You can't share it on cloud-based systems outside the specific covered individuals. It is an ironclad NDA designed to protect the unreleased frameworks as highly confidential trade secrets.
And under current intellectual property law, specifically the principles surrounding trade secrets, information is only protected if it derives independent economic value from not being generally known.
Right.
And crucially, if the owner makes reasonable efforts to maintain its secrecy.
Okay, reasonable efforts. This is where I have to push back, and I really want your legal analysis on this, because we have the Brizard blog.
Oh, the blog.
Right there on his public website, he posts articles with titles like Back in the Loop, Emotional Rebound, and The Structure of Inner Life. In these blogs, he is openly talking about how these very frameworks, TFL, SST, IRE, how they run in his own head.
She's basically using himself as the primary case study.
Exactly. He talks about experiencing a low salient simulation and feeling effective micro-reactivations. He is publicly journaling about the internal workings of his proprietary cognitive loops.
Yeah, he is.
So ask yourself, why would Jason Brizard do that if he's trying to keep everything confidential? Doesn't publishing these deeply philosophical, revealing blog posts legally weaken his claim that these frameworks are confidential trade secrets?
It's a valid concern.
I mean, if I'm a university lawyer, can I point to his blog and say, hey, you didn't make reasonable effort to keep this secret? You literally blogged about it on a Tuesday.
It is a phenomenal question, and it really cuts to the heart of what IP law actually protects.
Mm-hmm.
To answer it, we have to distinguish between the phenomenology of a framework and the mechanics of a framework.
Meaning the experience versus the math?
Exactly. Think of it like this. If you write a blog post about how eating your grandmother's secret recipe chocolate chip cookies makes you feel warm, nostalgic, and gives you a specific kind of sugar rush.
You've described the phenomenology of the cookie.
Yes. You have not published the recipe. You have not surrendered the trade secret.
Ah, okay. So Brizard is describing the sugar rush of the temporal feedback loop.
It's exactly it. What Brizard is doing in his blog is discussing the personal, subjective experience of living with these cognitive architectures. He's writing about the philosophical implications of identity stabilization and volitional closure.
Which is fascinating, but it's not the math.
Right. And this is the crucial legal distinction that will hold up in court. He is not publishing the underlying proprietary equations. He is not posting the symbolic schematics or the structural models of the unreleased works.
Got it.
The math, the specific functional architecture, the formal predictive models, those remain completely sealed in the archive behind the NDA.
So the blog acts as a marketing teaser, not a legal surrender.
It demonstrates the real-world applicability of the theories to human suffering and cognition, which actually increases the perceived value of the archive to those clinical psychology labs we talked about. He is legally safe because he's separating the experience of the intellectual property from the mechanics of the intellectual property.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. But what if a lab signs this agreement, gets inside the archive, and decides these restrictions are just too tight?
It's like they have buyer's remorse.
Yeah. Let's say a lab signs up, pays the 50 grand, gets the materials, and says, you know what, this NDA is unreasonable, it's stifling our academic freedom, and we want to share this data with our colleagues at Oxford. We are taking this to court to invalidate the restrictive data access clauses. Can labs legally challenge these restrictive clauses after the fact?
They can try, but they would face an incredibly steep uphill battle. Honestly, bordering on impossible.
Really? Why is that?
We have to remember how the law views the parties in this contract. This is a mutually agreed upon B2B contract. The university lab is not a naive consumer clicking splitting up, except on an iTunes terms of service update without reading it.
Right. They aren't just downloading an app.
They are a sophisticated institution. They have their own general counsel. They have teams of lawyers. They willingly entered into this agreement with eyes wide open.
They knew exactly what they were buying.
And the agreement is explicitly clear about what they are not allowed to do.
Yeah.
I mean, let's look at the Brizard format trap. This is section 3 of the agreement.
Oh, the Brizard format. We mentioned an old version of this is on Zenodo under the CNCND license. But the new active version is locked in the archive. It's described as a proprietary structural template for organizing theoretical manuscripts, including formatting logic and placeholder schema.
Yes. And when the lab signs the contract, they explicitly agree that they cannot claim authorship of the format, they cannot distribute it as a standalone guide, and they cannot adapt it into derivative templates.
So they're locked in.
They're contractually agreeing that even the formatting logic, like the very way the headings, subheadings, and conceptual schemas are visually organized on the page, is protected intellectual property.
That is wild to me. The formatting itself is locked down.
So if a lab tries to challenge the restrictions post-signing, Brizard's lawyers will simply point to the contract and say, you agreed to these exact prohibitions. You agreed the format itself was a protected asset.
And a judge would agree with that.
Almost certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Challenging a heavily negotiated B2B contract simply because the university researchers later decide it's too restrictive is not a winning legal strategy. Courts generally uphold these contracts because both parties are deemed sophisticated enough to understand the bargain they struck.
Wow.
And if the lab just breaches the NDA anyway, they face immediate termination under Section 7.3.
Which means they lose access to the archive instantly, their research grinds to a halt, and they still don't get their $50,000 back.
The trap is sprung, and the lab is stuck.
Okay. This brings us to a massive pivot in our legal analysis. We've established that the labs are locked in, they can't share the data, they can't change the format, and they can't complain that the NDA is too tight.
Right.
But what happens when a lab actually takes these rigid proprietary equations and plugs them into their own servers? Because these aren't just philosophy papers, they are structural neurocognitive models with symbolic equations meant to be tested against real data.
And applying theoretical equations to real-world data infrastructure carries immense risk.
So let's talk about liability, system errors, and the danger of equations. When you, our listener, sent us these frameworks, you were probably looking at the brilliance of the science.
This is undeniable.
Right. But what this legal analysis reveals to you is that the science is basically unexploded ordnance. Let's look at some specific proprietary assets mentioned in the sources. We have the ARPE update equation from the effective reconsolidation and plasticity engine. We have the recursive loop clauses from the TFL. And we have the integration mechanisms from the VRIF.
the Vibrational Resonance Integration Framework.
Right. And VRIF is a particularly potent example. VRIF proposes that different cognitive processing streams achieve alignment through endogenous vibrational resonance. It's a highly complex model for systemic integration.
Very complex.
So here is the million-dollar legal question, or rather the multi-million-dollar legal question. Let's say our Tier 1 research university licenses the archive. They take the VRIF integration mechanisms, or that RRPE update equation, and they actively integrate it into their own proprietary cognitive computing systems. They have a massive supercomputer trying to simulate human volition.
A very standard use case for this kind of theoretical license, honestly.
Okay, now let's say the math breaks. Let's explore the mechanics of this failure. The integration of the VRIF mechanisms causes a feedback loop.
Right.
The equations fail to synchronize the simulated processing streams, causing a runaway cognitive simulation in the lab server. It consumes all the RAM, overloads the system, and corrupts petabytes of parallel processing data. Years of the lab's proprietary research is destroyed because Brizard's theoretical equation failed to align.
That's a disaster.
Or, let's take a human example. The ARPE equation proves flawed when applied clinically to map trauma responses, and the resulting clinical trial is a disastrous failure, costing millions in grant money.
The stakes are incredibly high.
So does the liability shift back to the licensor? Can the university sue Jason Brizard because his theoretical equation crashed their supercomputer or ruined their clinical trial?
It is a vital question. How do labs handle situations where the licensed IP causes active financial loss or infrastructure harm? To answer it, we have to dissect Section 8 of the agreement, specifically 8.4 and 8.5.
Okay.
And this is where the contract really shows its teeth.
I'm looking at 8.4 right now, disclaimer of warranty.
Read the exact phrasing. It is an impenetrable shield.
It says the archive, the Brizard format, and any custom frameworks are provided as is, without warranty of any kind, express or implied. This includes warranties of accuracy, completeness, fitness for a particular purpose, and guarantees of scientific validity or future performance.
Look at that phrase, guarantees of scientific validity.
Oh, what?
He is explicitly stating in the contract that he does not legally guarantee that his science is correct. He's selling theoretical access, not a certified tested product.
So it's basically buy at your own risk.
Exactly. If the ARPE equation is flawed, the contract basically says, I never promised it worked. I just promised you could look at it.
But surely if it actively destroys the lab server, there has to be some recourse. I mean, what about Section 8.5, limitation of liability?
This is the clause that protects Brizard from the catastrophic scenario you just described. It states that the total cumulative liability of the licensor shall not exceed the total amount paid by the licensee under this agreement.
So $50,000.
Exactly. Even if the university suffers $10 million in damages from a server meltdown caused by applying the VRIF integration mechanism, Brizard's liability is capped at $50,000.
That's insane.
And furthermore, the clause explicitly waives liability for indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or exemplary damages. And that includes loss of profits, data, or goodwill.
So if the petabytes of data are corrupted, the lab eats the entire cost.
The liability absolutely does not shift back to the licensor.
But do these liability waivers actually hold up in court? Can you really just write, I'm not responsible for my math destroying your computer, and just walk away?
Yes. In B2B contracts between sophisticated parties, these waivers almost universally hold up.
Right.
Yeah. The courts presume the university lab knew the risks. They are scientists. They know they are integrating experimental, unproven theoretical equations into their systems. It is the very nature of experimental research.
Right.
The law will not protect a sophisticated research institution from the consequences of its own experiments, even if they license the blueprint for that experiment from someone else.
Okay, but wait, consider this. If the math breaks, the lab can at least call Brizard and demand he help them fix the integration, right? Like high-level tech support. They paid 50 grand. They should at least get a phone call.
You would assume that, but look at Section 6.4, the no support or consultation clause.
Oh, this is brutal. It reads, this agreement includes no obligation for ongoing support, troubleshooting, in-depth consultation, technical assistance, or training sessions.
The labs are buying raw legal access to documents. They're not buying a partnership. They're not buying a consultant.
Whoa.
If the math breaks, Brizard has zero legal obligation to fix it. He might respond to an urgent password or server access issue within 5 to 10 business days. But if your cognitive computing system is melting down because the VRIF integration equation is misaligned, you are entirely on your own.
unless you pay more money.
Correct. Section 6.5 mentions an optional support addendum that must be executed under a completely separate agreement, which means more negotiations, more fees.
So evaluating if the potential breakthroughs justify these high costs and legal restrictions is basically the ultimate tightrope walk for the institution.
It really is.
Because if the frameworks actually allow a lab to cure a specific type of trauma using the effective reconsolidation and plasticity engine, the resulting patents, therapies, and institutional prestige are worth billions. A $50,000 fee, a restrictive NDA, and assuming the risk of a server crash are basically pennies on the dollar for that kind of reward.
High risk, astronomical reward. But to get that reward, the institution's lawyers have to agree to terms that go against every single instinct they possess.
Which leads us into the darkest corner of this agreement. We've talked about the freemium trap, the NDAs, and the liability of broken math. But now we have to role play the absolute nightmare scenario for a university's legal department. Let's talk about what a general counsel would actually tell a lab board about signing their hard-earned data away.
This is where the agreement moves from merely restrictive to aggressively extractive.
Let's talk about the custom data trap. I'm looking at section 5.4, custom framework development, and I literally had to read this three times to make sure I wasn't hallucinating the legal implications.
It is a remarkable piece of legal drafting. Break down the mechanics of it for us.
Okay, so under 5.4, a university lab can voluntarily provide their own research data to Broussard. We are talking about their hard-earned, non-public experimental findings. Maybe they spent 2 years gathering neuroimaging data on trauma patients.
Highly valuable
data. Very valuable. They hand this data over, and they request that Broussard builds a custom framework for them, utilizing his models to explain their data.
A bespoke cognitive model tailored to their specific lab data. I mean, on the surface, it sounds like an incredible service. The lab gets the genius theorist to solve their specific data puzzle.
But look at the terms. Sole ownership. The resulting framework, including its structure, language, symbols, and derivatives, remains solely owned by the licensor. Data origin does not affect ownership.
It's unbelievable.
The lab provides the raw fuel, but they get absolutely no authorship rights to the resulting engine. They just get a leaseback right to use it internally during their 12-month term.
And it gets worse for the lab. Take it a step further.
It does get worse. If the lab publishes a paper using this custom framework, they still have to attribute Broussard as the owner of the framework. And under the future derivative works clause, Broussard can legally incorporate the custom framework, which was entirely inspired by the lab's private, expensive data, into his future public releases or future proprietary models.
He legally absorbs their scientific labor and their grant-funded data right into his own intellectual property portfolio.
So the lab takes all the risk, does the expensive data gathering, hands it to him, and he legally owns the breakthrough. How on earth does a general counsel advise a lab board to sign this?
Let's role play this scenario. If I am the general counsel for a major university research hospital, and the aggressive principal investigator of the cognitive science department brings me this contract and says, we need this to secure our next NIH grant, I am having a heart attack.
You're just staring at section 5.4 and sweating through your suit.
Absolutely. Because my entire job is to protect the university's intellectual property. When I look at section 5.4, I see a one-way street where university data is transmuted into Broussard's private IP.
So how do you advise the board? Do you just say no? Do you tell the principal investigator to go find another theory?
It's never a simple no in academia.
Fair enough.
The principal investigator is going to argue that proprietary access to models like the temporal feedback loop is worth the risk. Huh. They will argue that without this specific architectural framework, their neuroimaging data is just noise, and they won't get the grant anyway.
Right.
So as the general counsel, I have to stand before the board and contrast the immense immediate benefit of proprietary access to cutting-edge models against the long-term cost of legal dependency.
Legal dependency. Explain the mechanics of that dependency.
If we sign this contract, we are embedding Broussard's proprietary formatting, his equations, and his specific symbolic language into the core of our lab's research output. We start writing all our internal documents using the Broussard format.
Which we discussed is restricted.
Exactly. Section 3 says, if the agreement terminates, we have to cease all new uses of that format. If we build our entire lab protocol around his architecture, we are legally dependent on renewing this $50,000 license every single year.
You basically become addicted to the architecture.
Exactly. And if he raises the price to $200,000 next year, which Section 7.5 explicitly allows him to do with 60 days notice, we are trapped.
Wow.
We have to pay it, or our ongoing multi-year research pipeline basically grinds to a halt because we instantly lose the legal right to use the underlying theoretical scaffolding.
That is a terrifying position for a multi-billion dollar institution to be in, held hostage by a single independent researcher.
Now let's add collaborations to the General Counsel's nightmare. Science is inherently collaborative. Labs at Stanford work with labs at MIT. How does this license handle research collaborations?
Oh, I see sections 5.2 and 5.3, external academic collaboration and prohibited activities. We need to examine if these clauses permit sublicensing.
They do not.
Not at all.
The license permits external academic collaboration under section 5.2, but the restrictions are incredibly tight. It strictly forbids sublicensing. You cannot just grant your collaborating university access to your Brazar archive login.
It says the collaborator can only access the specific framework the licensee is actively working with. So if we are collaborating on TFL, I can't show them the ARPE equations.
Right.
And the collaborators have to be bound by NDAs just as strict as this master agreement.
And here is the true nightmare for the general counsel under the responsibility clause in 5.2. The licensee shall be fully responsible for any breach caused by its collaborators.
Whoa, wow.
As general counsel, I have to tell the board, if we collaborate with a lab at MIT and an MIT grad student accidentally leaves a printout of the TFL equations at a coffee shop or accidentally uploads a snippet of the Brizard format to a public GitHub repository.
We are the ones in breach of contract.
Yes. The university that signed the master license is the one who faces immediate termination and potential legal damages. We have to enforce our internal safeguards across institutional boundaries onto another university staff. It is an administrative nightmare.
Which brings up the issue of audits. How does Brizard actually enforce this? I'm looking through the entire document and I don't see a standard audit rights clause. Usually in heavy enterprise software or IP contracts, there is a clause where the licensor can send lawyers or IT specialists to inspect the lab servers to ensure compliance. How do you navigate audit clauses if they aren't explicitly written as audits?
This is a highly sophisticated piece of drafting. You are correct. There is no traditional "we will audit your servers" clause. However, the agreement creates an implicit audit environment through two other mechanisms.
What are they?
First, Section 1.2 limits access strictly to authorized researchers who are directly engaged in the research and mandates that their access be limited to the minimum materials necessary.
So the principle of least privilege. You only get to see the exact paragraph you need for your specific test.
Exactly. The university has to build an internal tracking system to log exactly who has access to what, when, and why, just to remain in compliance with the minimum materials clause.
Okay, and the second mechanism?
Look at Section 8.3, indemnification by licensee.
Okay, it says the licensee agrees to indemnify and hold harmless the licensor against claims arising from breach of confidentiality or misuse of archive materials.
Right. So if a leak happens, the burden of proof is effectively on the university to show they maintained the required security and didn't cause the leak. To protect themselves from catastrophic indemnification claims, the university's IT and legal teams will have to build a digital fortress around the Brizard data.
Wow.
They will have to audit themselves constantly. The contract forces the university to do Brizard's auditing for him out of pure self-preservation.
It's like a company selling you a vault to hold a diamond they lent you. They don't need to check on the diamond, because if the diamond goes missing, you legally agreed to buy them a new one, and they already hold your bank account hostage. You are going to guard that vault with your life.
That is exactly the dynamic. The legal department will fight this contract tooth and nail because of these draconian terms, the liability risks, and the data surrender clauses.
But ultimately, as we established in the beginning, the fear of missing out usually wins out in academia. The scientists demand it because the staggered CCNCND public releases show the undeniable theoretical brilliance of the models. Brizard has leveraged the open access norms of science against the proprietary corporate lock-in of B2B contracting.
It is a perfect pincer movement.
It really is. So to summarize this incredibly dense, fascinating legal landscape, the brilliance and brutality of the Brizard legal strategy is that it uses a staggered Creative Commons, non-commercial, no derivatives public release to build massive hype and academic validation for frameworks like TFL, SST, and PFT.
While simultaneously utilizing a structure that forces serious competitive labs into a highly restrictive $50,000 as-is legal box if they actually want to test those theories.
Right. A box where the licensor Brizard holds all the intellectual property cards, assumes absolutely none of the legal or financial liability if his equations destroy a server or ruin a clinical trial, and even reserves the right to absorb the lab's own private data into his future proprietary models.
It is a masterclass in IP control within a theoretical domain, and it raises profound questions about the future of cognitive science, and really, how the law interacts with human knowledge.
Exactly. The reason you, the listener, haven't seen major universities publishing clinical trials on the temporal feedback loop yet isn't necessarily because the science is flawed. It's because their lawyers are terrified to touch it. Which brings us to our final thought for today.
If cognitive frameworks, like the literal maps of how human volition, identity, and temporal processing function can be locked behind non-derivative copyright laws and restrictive corporate NBAs, who ultimately owns the blueprint to the human mind.
Wow, that is heavy.
When university labs are forced to lease theoretical frameworks on a 12-month basis, terrified of triggering an indemnification clause or a system error they are liable for, rather than building upon those theories freely in the public domain, we have to ask a difficult question.
Yeah.
Does this kind of aggressive intellectual property law accelerate scientific discovery by incentivizing brilliant rogue theorists to share their work? Or does it merely privatize our fundamental understanding of consciousness itself?
That is something to truly mull over. If the mathematical architecture of your inner life is trademarked and leased as is, what does that mean for the science of tomorrow? Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the intersection of intellectual property law and cognitive science. Keep sending us your sources and keep asking the hard questions.